Next on the programme, we have an interview with someone who has been writing a book about high-achieving teenagers. Welcome, Louise Hardy.
Hi, it's lovely to be here.
Louise, many of these teenagers who have achieved success and fame early on have done so through using new technology, haven't they?
Mm-hmm.
Through blogging or using YouTube or Twitter.
Absolutely. And the greatest example of this is Justin Bieber. As I think everyone on the planet knows, he started off by posting videos on YouTube at the age of 14 and was spotted by a talent scout who worked with the R&B singer Usher. After that, he very rapidly became a worldwide sensation.
I heard that last year he was said to be more influential than Obama.
Yes, that was because he is number one on Twitter. He has over 35 million followers.
Ooh.
There's a new one every 2 seconds. A company that analyzes social media called Clout said that he is the most influential person in the world because of that. But whether he's really more influential than Obama, well...
All this exposure has negative consequences for young people too, doesn't it?
Yes. Although millions adore Justin, a lot of people don't. One of his videos was the most disliked ever. And he has a big problem with privacy. He's followed everywhere by the paparazzi, and that's bad for anyone, never mind a teenager.
Okay, let's turn to a very different teenager.
Mm-hmm.
Tavi Gevinson was even younger when she began, wasn't she?
Yes, she was only 11 years old when she started a fashion blog called Style Rookie. By the way, for British listeners, rookie is an American word used for a person who is new to something.
Ah, thanks.
On her blog, she posted photos of herself wearing unusual combinations of clothes and wrote about them.
Some of them are quite weird.
Well, yes, I suppose a lot of high fashion is weird. Anyway, she quickly built up a huge following, up to 300,000 readers per day, and many of them were adults. Serious fashion magazines interviewed her and sent her to fashion shows in Europe and to meet top designers like Karl Lagerfeld.
Some people didn't believe she was as young as she was, did they?
No. One magazine printed an article saying the writer didn't believe Tavi was only 12, and that upset her. But she bounced back and continued blogging. Then, as she grew older, Tavi became interested in other things besides fashion. In 2011, when she was 15, she started Rookie Magazine, an online magazine for teenagers. In less than a week, it had 1 million readers.
I've seen it. It's very impressive, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
And all teenage girls listening, check out Rookie Magazine.
Yes. I think it's fantastic. And Lady Gaga called Tavi the future of journalism. She employs about 50 writers and photographers, both adults and teenagers on Rookie, but she is the editor with overall control.
And all this time, she's continued to lead a normal life, hasn't she?
Oh, yes. She lives a very normal life in a small town and goes to school and so on. She's not even 20 yet. But I think writing and editing are very different from being a performing artist. There's a lot less pressure from fans and the press. Although some actors, like Emma Watson, seem to manage a private life and getting a normal education.
Yes, Emma Watson is now in her 20s, of course, but when she was... Next on the programme, we have an interview with someone who has been writing a book about high-achieving teenagers. Welcome, Louise Hardy.
Hi, it's lovely to be here.
Louise, many of these teenagers who have achieved success and fame early on have done so through using new technology, haven't they?
Mm-hmm.
Through blogging or using YouTube or Twitter.
Absolutely. And the greatest example of this is Justin Bieber. As I think everyone on the planet knows, he started off by posting videos on YouTube at the age of 14 and was spotted by a talent scout who worked with the R&B singer Usher. After that, he very rapidly became a worldwide sensation.
I heard that last year he was said to be more influential than Obama.
Yes, that was because he is number one on Twitter. He has over 35 million followers.
Ooh.
There's a new one every 2 seconds. A company that analyzes social media called Clout said that he is the most influential person in the world because of that. But whether he's really more influential than Obama, well...
All this exposure has negative consequences for young people too, doesn't it?
Yes. Although millions adore Justin, a lot of people don't. One of his videos was the most disliked ever, and he has a big problem with privacy. He's followed everywhere by the paparazzi, and that's bad for anyone, never mind a teenager.
Okay, let's turn to a very different teenager. Mm-hmm. Tavi Gevinson was even younger when she began, wasn't she?
Yes, she was only 11 years old when she started a fashion blog called Style Rookie. By the way, for British listeners, rookie is an American word used for a person who is new to something.
Ah, thanks.
On her blog, she posted photos of herself wearing unusual combinations of clothes and wrote about them.
Some of them are quite weird.
Well, yes, I suppose a lot of high fashion is weird. Anyway, she quickly built up a huge following, up to 300,000 readers per day, and many of them were adults. Serious fashion magazines interviewed her and sent her to fashion shows in Europe and to meet top designers like Karl Lagerfeld.
Some people didn't believe she was as young as she was, did they?
No. One magazine printed an article saying the writer didn't believe Tavi was only 12, and that upset her. But she bounced back and continued blogging. Then, as she grew older, Tavi became interested in other things besides fashion. In 2011, when she was 15, she started Rookie Magazine, an online magazine for teenagers. In less than a week, it had 1 million readers.
I've seen it. It's very impressive, isn't it? Mm-hmm. And all teenage girls listening, check out Rookie Magazine.
Yes. I think it's fantastic. And Lady Gaga called Tavi the future of journalism. She employs about 50 writers and photographers, both adults and teenagers on Rookie, but she is the editor with overall control.
And all this time, she's continued to lead a normal life, hasn't she?
Oh, yes. She lives a very normal life in a small town and goes to school and so on. She's not even 20 yet. But I think writing and editing are very different from being a performing artist. There's a lot less pressure from fans and the press. Although some actors, like Emma Watson, seem to manage a private life and getting a normal education.
Yes, Emma Watson is now in her 20s, of course, but when she was... Next on the program, we have an interview with someone who has been writing a book about high-achieving teenagers. Welcome, Louise Hardy.
Hi, it's lovely to be here.
Louise, many of these teenagers who have achieved success and fame early on have done so through using new technology, haven't they?
Mm-hmm.
Through blogging or using YouTube or Twitter.
Absolutely. And the greatest example of this is Justin Bieber. As I think everyone on the planet knows, he started off by posting videos on YouTube at the age of 14 and was spotted by a talent scout who worked with the R&B singer Usher. After that, he very rapidly became a worldwide sensation.
I heard that last year he was said to be more influential than Obama.
Yes, that was because he is number one on Twitter. He has over 35 million followers.
Ooh.
There's a new one every 2 seconds. A company that analyzes social media called Clout said that he is the most influential person in the world because of that. But whether he's really more influential than Obama, well...
All this exposure has negative consequences for young people too, doesn't it?
Yes. Although millions adore Justin, a lot of people don't. One of his videos was the most disliked ever. And he has a big problem with privacy. He's followed everywhere by the paparazzi, and that's bad for anyone, never mind a teenager.
Okay, let's turn to a very different teenager.
Mm-hmm.
Tavi Gevinson was even younger when she began, wasn't she?
Yes, she was only 11 years old when she started a fashion blog called Style Rookie. By the way, for British listeners, rookie is an American word used for a person who is new to something.
Ah, thanks.
On her blog, she posted photos of herself wearing unusual combinations of clothes and wrote about them.
Some of them are quite weird.
Well, yes, I suppose a lot of high fashion is weird. Anyway, she quickly built up a huge following, up to 300,000 readers per day, and many of them were adults. Serious fashion magazines interviewed her and sent her to fashion shows in Europe and to meet top designers, like Karl Lagerfeld.
Some people didn't believe she was as young as she was, did they?
No. One magazine printed an article saying the writer didn't believe Tavi was only 12, and that upset her. But she bounced back and continued blogging. Then, as she grew older, Tavi became interested in other things besides fashion. In 2011, when she was 15, she started Rookie Magazine, an online magazine for teenagers. In less than a week, it had 1 million readers.
I've seen it. It's very impressive, isn't it? Mm-hmm. And all teenage girls listening, check out Rookie Magazine.
Yes. I think it's fantastic. And Lady Gaga called Tavi the future of journalism. She employs about 50 writers and photographers, both adults and teenagers on Rookie, but she is the editor with overall control.
And all this time, she's continued to lead a normal life, hasn't she?
Oh, yes. She lives a very normal life in a small town and goes to school and so on. She's not even 20 yet. But I think writing and editing are very different from being a performing artist. There's a lot less pressure from fans and the press. Although some actors, like Emma Watson, seem to manage a private life and getting a normal education.
Yes, Emma Watson is now in her 20s, of course, but when she was...
On July 20th, 1969, Neil Armstrong and Buzz Aldrin became the first men to land on the moon. Perhaps inspired by this major event and earlier space flights, science fiction writers in the late 1960s and 1970s wrote countless number of stories about people traveling to space for a vacation. Many people at that time believed that families in the early 21st century would routinely take trips to the moon for sightseeing, and popular movies and TV shows fueled this belief. Take the example of 2001, A Space Odyssey, which was released in 1968. This movie had a famous scene that showed businessmen traveling through space. In the 1980s, space travel for ordinary people was not as widespread as writers and artists imagined in the 1960s. However, in the 1980s, civilian expeditions into space had begun. This is illustrated by the United States' decision to send several politicians into space to help them better understand the activities of NASA, America's space agency. Krista McCullough, a schoolteacher, was scheduled to travel on the space shuttle and teach her class from space. After she was tragically killed in a shuttle accident, NASA delayed sending civilians into space for a long time. Because they were traveling to space for a specific purpose, these people were not really space tourists, but they were civilians who flew to space. By the late 1990s, space tourism for an exclusive set of people became a reality. A commercial space company called Mircor was having problems, and it desperately needed money. The company therefore decided to sell tickets for space flights. It was an American businessman named Dennis Tito who bought the first ticket from Mircor, and in April 2001, he flew to the International Space Station. Despite strong resistance from NASA, Tito stayed at the International Space Station for 7 days. After Tito's space trip, two more fortunate people bought the tickets and also visited the space station. More trips were planned, but these were canceled or delayed after the space shuttle Columbia had an accident in 2003 while returning to Earth, and all the astronauts aboard were killed. In 2006, space tourism resumed, and Russia's space agency again sold tickets to those who wanted to travel to space. Despite the resumption of space tourism, Russia's space agency announced in 2011 that it would not carry space tourists again until 2013. Although many people dream of becoming a space tourist, ticket prices are currently very expensive, around $20 to $25 million US. So taking their family on vacation to the moon may have to wait for now. On July 20, 1969, Neil Armstrong and Buzz Aldrin became the first men to land on the moon. Perhaps inspired by this major event and earlier space flights, science fiction writers in the late 1960s and 1970s wrote countless number of stories about people traveling to space for a vacation. Many people at that time believed that families in the early 21st century would routinely take trips to the moon for sightseeing, and popular movies and TV shows fueled this belief. Take the example of 2001, A Space Odyssey, which was released in 1968. This movie had a famous scene that showed businessmen traveling through space. In the 1980s, space travel for ordinary people was not as widespread as writers and artists imagined in the 1960s. However, in the 1980s, civilian expeditions into space had begun. This is illustrated by the United States' decision to send several politicians into space to help them better understand the activities of NASA, America's space agency. Krista McCullough, a schoolteacher, was scheduled to travel on the space shuttle and teach her class from space. After she was tragically killed in a shuttle accident, NASA delayed sending civilians into space for a long time. Because they were traveling to space for a specific purpose, these people were not really space tourists, but they were civilians who flew to space. By the late 1990s, space tourism for an exclusive set of people became a reality. A commercial space company called Mircor was having problems, and it desperately needed money. The company therefore decided to sell tickets for space flights. It was an American businessman named Dennis Tito who bought the first ticket from Mircor, and in April 2001, he flew to the International Space Station. Despite strong resistance from NASA, Tito stayed at the International Space Station for 7 days. After Tito's space trip, two more fortunate people bought the tickets and also visited the space station. More trips were planned, but these were canceled or delayed after the space shuttle Columbia had an accident in 2003 while returning to Earth, and all the astronauts aboard were killed. In 2006, space tourism resumed, and Russia's space agency again sold tickets to those who wanted to travel to space. Despite the resumption of space tourism, Russia's space agency announced in 2011 that it would not carry space tourists again until 2013. Although many people dream of becoming a space tourist, ticket prices are currently very expensive, around $20 to $25 million US. So taking their family on vacation to the moon may have to wait for now. On July 20, 1969, Neil Armstrong and Buzz Aldrin became the first men to land on the moon. Perhaps inspired by this major event and earlier space flights, science fiction writers in the late 1960s and 1970s wrote countless number of stories about people traveling to space for a vacation. Many people at that time believed that families in the early 21st century would routinely take trips to the moon for sightseeing, and popular movies and TV shows fueled this belief. Take the example of 2001, A Space Odyssey, which was released in 1968. This movie had a famous scene that showed businessmen traveling through space. In the 1980s, space travel for ordinary people was not as widespread as writers and artists imagined in the 1960s. However, in the 1980s, civilian expeditions into space had begun. This is illustrated by the United States' decision to send several politicians into space to help them better understand the activities of NASA, America's space agency. Krista McCullough, a schoolteacher, was scheduled to travel on the space shuttle and teach her class from space. After she was tragically killed in a shuttle accident, NASA delayed sending civilians into space for a long time. Because they were traveling to space for a specific purpose, these people were not really space tourists, but they were civilians who flew to space. By the late 1990s, space tourism for an exclusive set of people became a reality. A commercial space company called Mircor was having problems, and it desperately needed money. The company therefore decided to sell tickets for space flights. It was an American businessman named Dennis Tito who bought the first ticket from Mircor, and in April 2001, he flew to the International Space Station. Despite strong resistance from NASA, Tito stayed at the International Space Station for 7 days. After Tito's space trip, two more fortunate people bought the tickets and also visited the space station. More trips were planned, but these were canceled or delayed after the space shuttle Columbia had an accident in 2003 while returning to Earth, and all the astronauts aboard were killed. In 2006, space tourism resumed, and Russia's space agency again sold tickets to those who wanted to travel to space. Despite the resumption of space tourism, Russia's space agency announced in 2011 that it would not carry space tourists again until 2013. Although many people dream of becoming a space tourist, ticket prices are currently very expensive, around $20 to $25 million US. So taking their family on vacation to the moon may have to wait for now.
There have been numerous attempts to explain the emergence of this expression, which swept into popular use in the US during the mid-19th century. Most are pure speculation. It doesn't seem at all likely, from linguistic and historical evidence, that it finds its origins in any of the following. The Scots expression ochai, the Greek olakala, meaning it is good, the Choctaw Indian okay or okay, meaning it is so, the French au koye, which means from Kay, a port in Haiti with a reputation for good rum, okay, meaning to the quay, supposedly used by French-speaking dockers, or even the initials of a railway freight agent called Obadiah Kelly, who is said to have written them on documents he had checked. A more likely explanation is that the term originated as an abbreviation of All Correct, a jokey misspelling of All Correct, which was current in the US in the 1830s. The oldest known written references to OK result from its use as a slogan by the Democratic Party during the American presidential election of 1840. Their candidate, President Martin Van Buren, was nicknamed Old Kinderhook after his birthplace in New York State, and his supporters formed the OK Club. This undoubtedly helped popularise the term, although it did not get President Van Buren re-elected. The only other theory, with at least a degree of plausibility, is that the term originated amongst black slaves of West African origin, and represents a word meaning all right, yes indeed, in various West African languages. Unfortunately, historical evidence enabling the origin of this expression to be finally and firmly established is hard to unearth. There have been numerous attempts to explain the emergence of this expression, which swept into popular use in the US during the mid-19th century. Most are pure speculation. It doesn't seem at all likely, from linguistic and historical evidence, that it finds its origins in any of the following. The Scots expression ochai, the Greek olakala, meaning it is good, the Choctaw Indian okay or okay, meaning it is so, the French au koye, which means from Kay, a port in Haiti with a reputation for good rum, okay, meaning to the quay, supposedly used by French-speaking dockers, or even the initials of a railway freight agent called Obadiah Kelly, who is said to have written them on documents he had checked. A more likely explanation is that the term originated as an abbreviation of All Correct, a jokey misspelling of All Correct, which was current in the US in the 1830s. The oldest known written references to OK result from its use as a slogan by the Democratic Party during the American presidential election of 1840. Their candidate, President Martin Van Buren, was nicknamed Old Kinderhook after his birthplace in New York State, and his supporters formed the OK Club. This undoubtedly helped popularise the term, although it did not get President Van Buren re-elected. The only other theory, with at least a degree of plausibility, is that the term originated amongst black slaves of West African origin, and represents a word meaning all right, yes indeed, in various West African languages. Unfortunately, historical evidence enabling the origin of this expression to be finally and firmly established is hard to unearth. There have been numerous attempts to explain the emergence of this expression, which swept into popular use in the US during the mid-19th century. Most are pure speculation. It doesn't seem at all likely, from linguistic and historical evidence, that it finds its origins in any of the following. The Scots expression ochai, the Greek olakala, meaning it is good, the Choctaw Indian okay or okay, meaning it is so, the French au koye, which means from Kay, a port in Haiti with a reputation for good rum, okay, meaning to the quay, supposedly used by French-speaking dockers, or even the initials of a railway freight agent called Obadiah Kelly, who is said to have written them on documents he had checked. A more likely explanation is that the term originated as an abbreviation of All Correct, a jokey misspelling of All Correct, which was current in the US in the 1830s. The oldest known written references to OK result from its use as a slogan by the Democratic Party during the American presidential election of 1840. Their candidate, President Martin Van Buren, was nicknamed Old Kinderhook after his birthplace in New York State, and his supporters formed the OK Club. This undoubtedly helped popularise the term, although it did not get President Van Buren re-elected. The only other theory, with at least a degree of plausibility, is that the term originated amongst black slaves of West African origin, and represents a word meaning all right, yes indeed, in various West African languages. Unfortunately, historical evidence enabling the origin of this expression to be finally and firmly established is hard to unearth.